40 years ago, we didn't even understand this disease. The gene defects were not identified. The biology, the models, was nothing. And it was very difficult to tell families that there's nothing we can do. We don't even understand what's happening. And the future is very bleak. And so I thought it should be part of us not to accept that and to try to work on that. This is actually how I started to do science.
I'm John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience here at the University of Rochester, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. Today, I'm absolutely honored to be joined by a leading expert in retinal diseases and vision restoration, Dr. José Sahal, who is the Distinguished Professor and Eye and Ear Foundation Professor and Chair of the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He's also the director of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Vision Institute. Dr. Sahal has received numerous awards over the years, including most recently the prestigious Wolf Prize in Medicine. He's a member of the Legion of Honor, France's highest decoration, an award founded by Napoleon himself. And he's an inventor with more than 90 patents and is a National Academy of Inventors Fellow. He's a true pioneer in optogenetic vision restoration, a therapeutic technique that uses genetically modified cells in the retina to express light-sensitive proteins that could help patients who are blind or visually impaired because of a genetic defect. His research has also helped to develop several other interventions for vision impairment, including stem cell implantation, gene therapy, innovative pharmacological approaches, and the artificial retina. Thank you, José, for taking the time to join us here today.
It's well, thank really you wonderful. For inviting me. That's very kind of you.
It's fantastic to have you here. Just, I was thinking, getting ready for this, about all the science fiction films that we've seen over the years, from Star Wars with vision restoration. It's one of those intriguing areas, I think, that everybody in the world thinks about, you know, restoring vision in people who are blind or who have difficulties. Yeah. How did you get into it? What drove you into this area?
So when I was a high school student, I was really good in maths and physics, and I had a keen interest in philosophy. In France, philosophy is being taught in high school. So I had a keen interest on that, and I was trying to find a way to continue this interest. And I thought initially I would do mathematics and physics, but I realized I wanted really to be dealing with human beings. So I decided to go to medical school, and I wanted to be a pediatric oncologist, but I had by chance an opportunity to do a rotation in ophthalmology, and I fell in love with the beauty of the eye, the fine surgery we are doing, the imaging technologies, and I realized that the eye is part of the brain, and I realized that this was a wonderful way to get into neuroscience, so that's why I got into ophthalmology.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about your science. You're a pioneer of vision restoration and retinal diseases. Tell us a little bit about what's currently on your table. What's the most exciting thing you've got going on?
I got into that field because I became a retina specialist, and I was dealing with retinal degenerations. And I was very concerned because there was no treatment, and actually 40 years ago, we didn't even understand this disease. The gene defects were not identified. The biology, the models, was nothing. And it was very difficult to tell families that there's nothing we can do. We don't even understand what's happening. And the future is very bleak. And so I thought it should be part of us not to accept that and to try to work on that. This is actually how I started to do science. I was only a clinician at the time and a surgeon. Right. And the initial project I had, which I describe a little bit today at the symposium, was trying to protect whatever vision is remaining when we see the patient, because we don't see them very early. We see already them at advanced stages, right, and they have remaining vision they want to keep. And actually, it turns out that there is like a gene-independent pathway that is leading to loss of central vision, but we didn't know what it was. So I decided to work on that, and this is how I started my lab alone with a part-time technician, trying to understand that. And it took us many years exploring. I had 5 hypotheses, so we tested all of them, and one of them was the right one. Actually, another one was not totally wrong, but the one that proved that there's a trophic interaction between the cells and that you need to restore the endogenous signaling that is protecting the cells from dying. So we identified the signal, we identified the receptors, we validated that in animal models, and now it's in clinical trial after 30 years of work. So we don't know yet whether it's going to work, but there's all reason to believe that this is the underlying phenomenon. But this led me to really try to understand the biology of these conditions, and then I realized that what we call personalized medicine is not just the genomic part of it, it's really the staging of a disease and how finely you can characterize the stage of a disease. Once you know where the patient is, what is remaining, what resources are still available, what cells are still working, then you can try to tackle that. Right. And so this led to, of course, work on gene therapy to correct the gene defect, but this what everyone is doing, but also neuroprotection, which I just described briefly. And then at the later stages, how can you restore what has been lost? Initially, I was working on artificial retina, and we have done a lot of work on that and very promising work. But I thought we should try to get to higher resolution. So with my friend, Botan Roska, we got the Wolf Award together. We decided really to focus on optogenetics as a way to awaken the cells. So you have cells that are in the retina that we call dormant cells that are no longer responding to light, or cells that never responded to light, but you transform into photoreceptors. You make them sensitive to light and responding. Right. So we worked on that in a very systematic way. My team in Paris and Botton and I, we worked together on every single cell type in the retina, trying to identify which one would be the best response, then developing the vectors, the technology, then also the medical device. And something which we realized very soon working on artificial retina is that it's very important to train the patient, that the rehabilitation process is a key component. So this led us to develop this therapy that is really combining biologics, gene therapy, a medical device, a system, a goggle to stimulate the eye, and a rehabilitation process. And I think this is the future of medicine, integrating all these approaches into that. And we were very fortunate that the first ever patient to benefit from optogenetics was in our trial, to report that. So it was a wonderful experience to hear the patient and to see that
to
happening.
To see 30 years of work finally expressed in an improvement in a person's vision. Extraordinary.
Yeah,
I love this idea too of cells that weren't even there, in the repurposing cells, that their original function wasn't necessarily to be light sensitive, but you can transform them. Tell us a little bit more about that.
The idea is that normally the cells that respond to light are photoreceptors.
Yeah.
And they are affected by this condition, they degenerate. So there is a stage where they are still alive, but no longer functional. They turn off all the machinery.
Right.
So they are only living, but you don't know what they are doing. So there is a stage like that. So we started with that, actually trying to awaken the dormant cells.
Right.
We call that the dormant cells.
Yeah.
And it's still a valid approach, but it for various reasons, it was not the perfect time to do it. So we thought, well, let's go to the cells beyond that, that normally don't respond to light, but are able to connect to the brain and send the signal. And we are not the only one to try that. Actually, others were trying that too. But there are so many minutiae, so many things that you need to look at, that actually the success sometimes is just adding up every single detail, because one of the details, if you miss it, everything is falling apart. So, and we were fortunate to really build in a very systematic manner. I don't trust luck. I mean, I don't believe, I'm not lucky by design. So we tend to be very systematic, checking every part of the development, and which led to being able to reactivate the ganglion cells, the cells that are connected to the brain, to make them photoreceptors, photosensitive.
Amazing. So, we were talking before about, maybe get a little bit into some of the politics and the funding of this, because quite a lot of the retinal degeneration or vision impairment diseases are monogenic, single gene mutations. We get them in a lot in the neurodevelopmental disorders. And because there are vanishingly few folks with a given one of these, let's say one of the lysosomal storage disorders, the motivation for big pharma to get involved or to get involved in clinical trials is low, because there's no, the market is not there. So do you have thoughts about that, and how do we solve that? How do we make sure that all of these small rare diseases get the attention that they need?
So the answer could be pretty long and won't be a total answer because we don't have a final answer. But the issue is that in retinal degeneration, we have around 300 genes involved, and each of them is affecting a different pathway, a different type of machinery in the cell. And if you try to find the therapy, one of the key questions is how many patients would benefit from it,
right?
Because you have, at some point, a clinical trial will require funding from industry or funding from investors. There is no way you can fund that only from academic funding, at least as of today.
Yeah.
And the issue is that when you have a few thousand people, it's okay. You can probably make the case that this is viable.
There's a market-based case for that, yeah.
And I've funded several companies, so I know how these people think, and I have a respect from them because I understand they have to go back to where people gave them money, and I don't blame on that, and I don't blame, but the truth is that when you're a clinician like myself, or even if you're not seeing patients, you don't want to have to tell to some people, well, sorry, your disease is not frequent enough to attract interest. Or actually, the science is very good, but there is no way we can develop that into a therapy. And I know multiple situations currently. Many colleagues talk to me about that because they know I'm very interested in that. At the last Vision conference, I had breakfast almost every day actually, with people that were telling me about the therapy that they developed that is stuck at the preclinical or even the phase one.
Right.
They have data. It's promising. It's working. But there is
nobody willing to invest to move. And it's a very expensive process, of course, to bring it to a phase two, phase three trial.
Yeah. So my approach to that is multifold. One is to try to develop gene-independent approaches. So the neuroprotection approach I was describing is meant to that. It's really a common pathway for all these conditions. So that there is a stage of a disease where you can try to protect whatever is left. But of course, you would like to cure the gene defect. And then you are facing another issue, is that because most of these conditions were untreatable and are untreatable, most of these patients see the physician once or twice, and then they have nothing good to tell them. When I was young, I was hearing terrible stories about people being told, just learn the Braille, and that's it, there is nothing to do. So there is no follow-up of this patient, and the natural history is poorly known.
Right.
Also, the biomarkers, the way to assess the progression of the disease was very limited. Now we have a lot of tools that didn't exist 20 years ago. So there is a need for very good natural history studies to be conducted. So currently with Foundation Fighting Blindness, we put together what I really promoted, I'm the PI on that, what is called UniRare, a universal natural history study for every gene defect. So we have a registry of patients across many centers across the world, and we plug on that natural history studies as soon as we find the funding. So we apply to NIH, we apply to Family Foundation, or they come to us because the cost is much less, and then you can do that. And then you have to work also on developing the therapy, and it has to do with reducing the cost of the preclinical models, pharmacokinetics, so all the studies that you have to validate the delivery and the design of a clinical trial. So you have to work on every aspect of it to make it a viable thing.
Right.
So this is something I'm deeply involved in currently.
Trying to
find a way to address the very rare, the ultra rare.
The ultra rare, yeah. Absolutely fantastic. What amazing work that you're doing.
Well, we have to. We must.
You have to, absolutely. Must, yeah. It's not absolutely unacceptable to say to somebody, sorry, you just got to get on with it.
Yeah, it's I used to say patients don't have a choice, so we don't have a choice. Because I used to say patients didn't decide to be a patient. So I hate when people talk about consumers and providers. They are not consumers, they are patients. They are human beings, actually, first.
Human beings.
And they are affected with the conditions. So they come to us, so it becomes our problem.
Yeah,
it becomes our own task. They ask us to take care of that, and we don't have a solution, so we can't accept that.
You did all your training in France and Strasbourg, right? And
so I was born in Algeria,
right?
And we moved to France when I was six because of the events at that time. And I did my high school in central France, then in Marseille, in south of France, medical school in Paris. And I did my residency in Strasbourg and then a fellowship at Harvard.
So a fellowship in Boston.
Yeah.
And then came to the... So most of your career spent in France, and then you arrive in Pittsburgh, of all places.
Yeah, so when I was in Boston, they wanted to keep me there, but my wife wanted to go back to Europe to raise our kids in the European way. So we came back, and I became a professor there, initially in Strasbourg, and I became the director of the National Marie Hospital, the medical director in Paris. And then I was also a professor at University College in London for 15 years in parallel. So I was combining the two. And like a few years ago, like 10 years ago, for family reasons, I told my wife, I think time is ripe to consider moving. And although I was very successful in Paris, I had my Vision Institute, which was working very well, and, but I wanted to change. So we decided to go back to the US and explore many opportunities. And eventually, Pittsburgh was a very good fit for us.
Can I mine in on that? I mean, it's a big jump having put a whole career in, and you have a very, very successful Vision Institute that you were the founder of, right?
Yeah, I founded it with my colleague. I started my research alone, actually, 30 years ago. And then really my lab was flourishing. I started one, and then we were like 30, 40, 50. When we founded the Vision Institute, it was 100 people. And when I left, it was 300 people. Working in vision science, really good people. I was able to really, I was joined by amazing people. I'm still very happy. I still collaborate with many of them, actually.
But this is super interesting because you undertake this huge building process, and obviously it's a big component of who you are to be a leader and pull together these multidisciplinary teams and build an institute. And then you say, I go do this again in Pittsburgh. Give us a little insight into that. Why was it a fresh challenge? Was that part of it?
Actually, I never wanted to be a leader. I wanted to do just my work, but I found out that if I want to do what I want to do, I just need to be my own boss. Yeah. And so that's how I ended up accepting the offer to become the chair and then to manage things. But this is not my favorite thing to do, actually, managing. It's just I like to work with people. This is what I like to do. So I'm not leading by telling people what they have to do. It's really collaborating. So no, what happened was really a family thing. I was very concerned with the rise of anti-Semitism in Europe, especially in France.
Right.
And I was very concerned for my family and my grandchildren. At that time, there was a lot of violence occurring. And that's the reason that I thought the US would be a safer place. At that time, I thought so. I'm not sure it's true anymore. But this is what I thought. So it's nothing to do with science. It was really a family reason.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And of course, then you arrive at a time when anti-Semitism was actually on the rise in the US. And of course, Pittsburgh had a horrendous event as well.
This is the ironic thing. We moved to Pittsburgh, and I remember my son, who is very cautious about protecting the kids and everything. He visited us and he said, well, there is no protection in your synagogue. There is nothing. And I said, we don't need that. It's very safe. And then a few months later, there was this big killing in Pittsburgh, the Tree of Life. I wrote an editorial in Science. I was invited to write an editorial about that, about facing hate. My own story and my vision of that, how I believe that a society of knowledge and science is the only way to cope with violence. Very naive maybe to say that, but is what I believe,
I'm fully on board with you. A new age of rationality. We need it more now than ever.
Yeah, we need to understand. Understanding. When I got into the building for the Mac, your building, and I saw knowledge is power, and I thought, I hope it's power to convince and not power by itself.
Agreed.
Yeah.
I love when you say that it's not in your nature to lead, because, of course, I think a real truism is that the people who aspire to leadership are maybe not always the people you want to have leading. It's the folks that come to it because of a natural ability and really don't want it, but do it because it's necessary and there's a moral imperative.
There's something, I guess there's this very famous seventh chapter in the Republic by Plato, where, you know, this myth of a cavern, people are being shown the shadows and they realize that what they are seeing is really only the shadow of something else. And then they start to turn towards the light and they realize that there's something else. And then they are told that because you know that, now you should become the leaders, and they don't want to be the leaders. They want to continue to do what they have to do. So I think most people who want to be leaders, it may not be for the right reason. I think if you want to lead something because you have a goal in mind and it's a mean to get where you want to be, then it makes sense. But if you forget that why you are doing things and it's just the leadership that you love, I think it's already too late. It's lost.
Well, thank you very much. Those are really important insights and a terrific understanding of the kinds of vagaries. It's amazing how many people who have sat in that chair who ended up in the US for political reasons. And you know, we were blessed because of that in some ways, because of the talent that came to these shores for safety from political persecution or fear of violence. Going back to leadership and developing these large centers, I guess the raison d'être for these is that you take people at the clinical coalface, basic scientists, and everything in between, and you try and get those groups of people together that can work across those translational boundaries from the basic science. How do you get, I mean, we really just talked about it, trying to get something from basic science into a clinical trial that has an impact on patients. What are the challenges there that you've come up against, and how do you have any insights for how to bridge those gaps?
Yeah, so the answer to the last question is persistence, more than persistence, be very, very stubborn.
Yeah.
Because these are different environments. I mean, the clinical environment, people are used to, you know, sometimes you do cataract surgery, it takes 10 minutes, and then patient sees. So why would you spend months and years in working on something where that may not work? So it's very difficult to shift towards this type of approaches. On the scientific part, the rigor that is needed to develop a project is not always something that is fitting very well with the vision of people have of clinicians. So the dialogue is difficult. Translation is the key word. I mean, how do you translate a clinical question into a scientific question? How do you reduce that and keep still the big perspective of the question? Because you have to reduce that to a mechanism, but you have to keep the big picture at the same time. So it's trying to keep this multidimensional, multi-level way of addressing the needs of the patients, trying to formulate the question asked us, which is usually a holistic question. Even the physician has to dissect the question into a more, not simple, but something that can be more articulate, more precise, and then trying to translate that into a question that some scientists, and sometimes these are technologists, not just biologists, can be mathematicians, can be physicists, it can be many fields actually. Right, and currently with AI, it broadens, and even human sciences are very important. So how do you make sure that you find the right partners? So every single of my project, for example, has been done with someone else. I never single-handed did anything. It was always partnering with someone and trying the right partner, teaching each other questions and the disciplines. And then it's a very long journey, 30 years, 20 years, but at some point the answer comes back and it goes back into the clinic. Sometimes that's not working, so I have to revisit everything again. It's like constantly, it's very, very persistence. And humility are very important.
It's an interesting thing. You know, I'll occasionally run into, actually more than occasionally, you know, somebody working on a disease model in a dish or, you know, doing the molecular soup work, and they've never actually seen a patient with that condition. And you and I were speaking before about rare disease family meetings and being in the hotel with the parents and the kids, and how profound that can be in terms of motivating you to do the work. And that should this be part of de rigueur for us to have our scientists actually go out and see the patients?
Yeah, this is what I love in what I've tried to build, is that it's in the same location. So when the scientists in my institute in Pittsburgh, they take the elevator with patients. So they can see the people with a white cane, they can see the people that are struggling with many issues. I think it may give a sense of urgency.
I agree.
We know science takes time, but you still have to keep the pace, and it's not infinite. I mean, the people are waiting for what we are doing, and we know it's taking years and years and years of work, but we have to be committed not to waste any time in doing that. So I think it's an important part to expose the scientists to what the patients are going through, but even the clinicians, actually, because very often in ophthalmology especially, but I think it's true in many other fields, you are happy to see the patient while you are successful. You don't like to see your failures. Yeah. So you're not very keen to get all these patients coming back too often. So in my case, this is the group of disease I'm working on. So I'm used, actually, I established an amazing relationship with many patients over decades, but we know each other, and actually it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of humor. They are extremely inspiring. So I'm learning so much from them. But at the same time, you love sometimes to be efficient. When by chance I get a patient that has a very simple condition in my clinic by mistake, I'm so happy because I can do something now.
Yeah.
Whereas in many cases, I have to tell them about upcoming clinical trial, ongoing research, or unfortunately not yet anything available. So all of this is part of what we go through.
Right.
But I think it gives the energy. I see patients early in the week because it gives me the energy to survive the bureaucracy, the difficulties, right. All the conflicts, everything we go through,
yeah.
Especially as a chair.
Yeah. It's so interesting. In a similar vein, you know, if you ask young scientists, you know, what's the motivation? What's the end point here? And they'll talk about getting a fancy paper in one of the big journals and that, or getting a grant. And of course, those are important things,
yeah.
But they can't be the end point. The end point is, what are you doing about patients? And seeing those patients, like you say, in the elevator with a white cane is the way to keep it real.
Yeah, I agree. What is important is also a very good way to build a team. I know people do team building. They go outside to do some sport together. I never believed in anything like that. But when people are working on a question for a patient, and anytime, for example, there is a conflict about what should we do, I keep asking what's good for the patient.
Yeah.
And everyone starts to get united around this question because it's a different perspective. It's a very different. So you keep that in mind constantly. Interestingly, when people get older, even the ones that never wanted to do applied science because they consider it dirty science, they start to think, well, maybe I want to have an impact.
I want to
contribute,
yeah.
to something. Doesn't mean that they don't like the science anymore. And actually, as you know, Louis Pasteur was saying, there's no fundamental science and applied science. There is good science and bad science.
Right.
And there is good science with applications of science. And I think this is true. So people,
yeah.
want to see sometime whether what we are doing is relevant, has an,
yeah.
impact.
That's a very important insight. It's really, really excellent. It's brings me on actually maybe to the last thing I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, we're talking about building teams and motivating people. Tell us a little bit about, you know, working with students and trainees, and do you have a formula? Is there a special recipe for building successful young scientists?
I don't have a recipe, but I was not a very successful young scientist. When I started, I told you I started late. I was already a clinician, and it was very humbling because not everything was working. I remember the technician in John Dowling's laboratory at Harvard, she was telling me the expert is the one that has done all the mistakes, so you have gone very close to that because I did so many mistakes. So I used to tell them that I've not always been very successful,
right.
And remembering that we have no choice but trying to do the best we can is an important thing, not giving up. One of my sons jokes about this, because something I say very often, the difference between success and failure is like 15 more minutes. You decided to give it another chance. You didn't stop there because it didn't work.
Oh,
you say,
good,
I'm,
yeah.
going to try again.
Yeah.
And like Beckett was saying, failing, fail again, fail better. Just
fail
trying
better.
To try to fail better. Yeah.
Well, closing out with an Irishman who lived most of his creative life in France seems like a really good spot for you and I, an Irishman and a Frenchman,
that's
an Algerian,
right.
man to bring this to a close. José, such a pleasure to have you here. And I just feel like our viewers are going to really gain some important information and insights from a life well lived in science, and more success to you as we go forward.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you, and I enjoy this discussion very much. Thank
Excellent.
You so much.